With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome back to Close Reads here on the Close Reads Podcast Network. I am David Kern. I'm back in my car. The kids are at home, so I'm back in my car. And I'm here with my old friends, Tim McIntosh, Heidi White. Heidi, Tim, how's it going?
David's going terrifically.
Yeah.
David, I want to ask a question.
Yeah.
So I have a theory. It's not even really a theory. It's more of an empirical test. You can tell who a person is by looking at the detritus that accumulates in their car when they're not driving it. What's
it? Detritus.
What's in your
the flotsam and jetsam?
Flotsam and that's even better. The flotsam and jetsam that accumulates in your car.
The sea
what's accumulated in your car? I'm gonna predict kids stuff like some socks that one of the youngsters was like, these are hot. I'm taking them off. And they're probably underneath the seat. This is a kind of standard
check.
Parenting
that
fare.
Is true.
Yeah.
Looking in the back seat, there is, yeah, there's a couple socks, a sweater, a child's sweater, and a dress up chef's outfit in my car that belonged to the kids. Yes, so far you are one for one. What else do you
okay. That belong to the kids?
Okay.
Air quotes.
Uh-huh, right.
Well, in this
right.
case, they do. I didn't say I didn't have a chef dress up. I bet this particular one is the one that belongs to the kids.
It's in your house. Like, it should be. Because
yeah,
you wear
cook
it
in my
day.
Car. I just record podcasts in my car.
I don't drive in my car.
Fair enough.
I just record podcasts in my car.
Right. And observe wildlife.
Yeah.
Well,
Heidi, what
I
else is in
feel
this
like
car?
These are unusual things. Go on, Tim.
There's
no, I'm
going to
give Heidi the
candy wrappers
Heidi,
for sure.
Cans.
For sure.
Yeah. No, there's got to be candy wrappers and cans for sure. That's my guess.
Yeah, I do have
it's cans.
It's
not even a guess.
I do
it's
have
like
cans in
knowledge.
The cup holder
like
right
a prophecy.
Now. But one of them is, I just opened it. So it's not just been flotsaming and jetting in my car. I don't think I have... I've got some Chick-fil-A. I do have some Chick-fil-A, a Chick-fil-A bag in the car from the other day that I did not dispose of yet.
Mm.
The fact that I need to say go on is disturbing.
And the fact
I've
that
been in your car
we're
before.
About to do,
I know how this goes.
The fact that we're about to do a Close Reads podcast makes me think books. There's got to be books in the car.
Yeah, okay. Well, that was like a layup.
A layup.
But we're only there reading are. One book. A single book.
I have four.
Tim said plural.
16 books in the passenger seat of my car.
I love
okay,
this.
I think
this makes me like beam with happiness.
Yeah.
Actually, hold on. Crime and Punishment fell down beside the. Yeah, so 17. What did I say? 17, something like that.
I also have the traveling case to my typewriter in the back seat.
What do you guys?
The reason that the reason that Crime and Punishment fell on the side of your seat is because Coulter has been reading it kind of surreptitiously. Mm-hmm. He's been sneaking out to the car,
and that would not
reading
be
Crime and Punishment.
Everything you just said sounds about
that's,
right.
That's likely, absolutely.
Although he's pretty deep into the Two Towers right now, so I think he's occupied.
Good for him.
God,
that is great. So I'm sitting on my bed, and I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 books on my nightstand. But you have more books in your car than I have in my nightstand. So I feel like I'm failing.
Or I'm failing. Just depends. Tim, wait, you're back in the basement, right?
I'm back in the basement. Yeah. We're still at the Airbnb because of the house fire.
How many books do you have in your dank basement?
Not many. I have 1, 2, 3 is all. One of them is Coriolanus, which, thank you for asking, is this month's episode of The Plays the Thing, starring Tim McIntosh and Sarah Jane Bentley, the riveting story of the Roman general who turns his back on his motherland. Bam, 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 like, you know, trumpets blare.
It's a really good Mother's Day play. With
Mother's Day play, as a matter of fact.
You should address that.
That's a great point. Okay, we're going to record this Thursday, and I need to make sure that Sarah Jane and I touch on that, especially because Sarah Jane is a new mother.
Hey, mm-hmm. Tim, speaking of mothers, we have a thing that we're asking our editors and some of our contributors for Forma to do. And so this might be a good thing for you to answer on the air. We have not prepped Tim ahead of time on this. But what are one or two, say, books that you read or love because your mom inspired you thusly?
Number one is the Bible. I don't know if that counts, but that is number one.
That was a good answer.
Oh, man, 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 man. It's so number one that I'm going to have to work on coming up with number two.
So what do you like?
That's actually really sweet. I love that.
How did she inspire that?
She did it herself. Like, you know.
She read it. She was reading the Bible herself.
Yeah, she read the Bible all the time. All the time. And she has verses kind of like, my mom does this wonderful thing where she will kind of work on something. You know, she'll say, I need to be more patient. I just really am an impatient person, which is like completely untrue, but she'll find a fault in herself. And soon verses about patience will start popping up in the kitchen and in the study as kind of reminders that this is what she needs to aspire to.
I love that.
Isn't that awesome? Isn't that great?
Yes, I love that. She sounds like a woman that would be an edifying person to know and inspiring.
My mom also sounds like she knows how to use a concordance.
One of the great ones.
That was
practical, so good. Things of life are important too.
Yeah. That was so good.
It's more a skill thing that we're talking about here.
Oh man. Just that exchange, the contrast of those two exchanges from Heidi and David. It's just like something straight out of a
play. I just said we're very characteristic people. Like, there's quirky things about us that make us easy to identify, and that might be one of them.
I want to apologize for saying that, but also I went to Bible college, and so use of a concordance was like a great virtue.
It's really important. I mean, now we have Bible Gateway. Now you can just Google it. But I mean, the fact that you know, it's like knowing how to use the Dewey Decimal System. So.
Oh, man. Well, speaking of the Dewey Decimal System.
This banter has gone long enough.
Yeah, I need to apologize to Tim's mom, first of all.
No, why? She knows that. No, there's no apology needed.
Well, you know, I don't want to be.
And cynical. If she took offense, it would be an opportunity for her to employ her newly found patience.
Well, very, very true, very true. Well, we are here to discuss The End of the Affair, Graham Greene's novel, his 1951 novel, which was sandwiched between two incredible novels, The Third Man and The Quiet American. Before we get into talking about The End of the Affair, I'm curious, we talked about The Power and the Glory, obviously, but to what extent are you both Graham Greeneites? Like, how much Graham Greene have you read? Tim, what about you?
I have only read The Power and the Glory and The End of the Affair, and I failed on reading Our Man in Havana. I failed three times, as a matter of fact.
Interesting. That's
yeah.
Why? Why did you get through The End of the Affair and The Power and the Glory, but quit on, or not, I don't want to accuse you of quitting. I mean, you did, but.
No, I quit. I completely quit. Because I got bored really quickly with Our Man in Havana, and I'll be honest, I will sometimes read a book because it has a strong reputation and I know or I trust it's eventually going to kind of show up. Its heart is really going to show up at some point. Mm-hmm. And I did not know Our Man in Havana by reputation. Yeah, I knew Graham Greene's name by reputation, but not Our Man in Havana. And I was like, maybe this book isn't good. Maybe it's not good. So I'm going to give up a little bit easily than I would for one of the books that's deemed a classic by him.
Yeah. That one's an interesting one. That's definitely a satire, and people would consider it successful to varying degrees, depending on who you talk to. Heidi, what about you? How much of a Graham Greene? Is it a Graham Greeneite? A Graham Greener? Graham Greene?
Graham Greeneite. Yeah, Graham Greenian or Graham Greeneite are both accepted.
You don't like Graham Greener?
I want to be more of one. I have, you know, we talked last time about how all of our reading lists are like 200 titles long, and Graham Greene's entire canon, all on there. But I've read Power and Glory, obviously, and that's in my top five favorite novels of all time. I've read The End of the Affair a few times, and I've read The Quiet American and Travels with Charlie, and that's it. That's it. So I'm ashamed to admit that, but this is a place where we all tell the truth.
Sounds like we all need to read Brighton Rock.
Heidi,
I bought that, but I don't remember.
It's good.
Go ahead, Tim. Proceed with the shaming.
No.
I'm just kidding.
Well, actually, isn't Travels with Charlie John Steinbeck?
Oh, Travels with My Aunt.
Yeah, that's what it is.
There we go.
I did read that. It wasn't a classic. It wasn't one of his better books. Anyway. And what about you, David?
Yeah, David.
I have read
all of it. I've read all of it.
The Power and the Glory and Graham the Affair a couple times. I have read The Third Man a couple times. I have read The Quiet American. I have read some of his spy stuff. I haven't read Brighton Rock, and I haven't read The Human Factor, which are kind of the two classic ones that I haven't read.
And The Heart of the Matter is a big deal, but I've never read that either.
But it's interesting to read The End of the Affair again, because it's such a book about writing books. And I was curious, all the meta elements of it, there's been much writing on it. It'd be easy to write a PhD thesis about it. And I was wondering if you find the sort of heaviness of the meta discourse in this book to be tiring, or if you find it to be interesting and enlightening. Heidi, where do you stand on that? Like, it's always constantly coming back to the concept of writing and being a writer and the elements of story and all that kind of stuff. Do you get lost in wading through all that, or does that open the book up even more for you?
Heidi, can I jump in, Heidi, before you answer and just give a little bit of a preface to readers that maybe haven't picked up the book yet about what David's talking about? So it's the story of a relationship that develops between a writer, and the writer's name is Maurice Bendrix, and Sarah Miles. And Maurice Bendrix is kind of constantly referring on the side to his like writer's methods, kind of the kind of schedule that he keeps, some of his past books. One of them gets turned into a movie and he and Sarah go see it. Sorry, that's all I wanted to say. Just so, like, if you haven't read the book yet, you know what David's talking about.
Hey, yeah.
I don't find it distracting, but I think the first time that I read The End of the Affair, I was glad that it's written in first person, because I think if it was written in third person, none of that would work at all. Like, it would be it would feel very self-indulgent.
Yeah.
And it is self-indulgent, but that's part of the character. That's part of who Bendrix is. And because of that, it works. And I think it's wonderful.
Yeah. 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 It's like part of his voice.
But yes. Yes. But I think that, I know that Graham Greene has been accused of that, even in his third person novels, that just being kind of overblown and melodramatic and just, it's just a little bit too intense. And I think that's probably a fair critique, but that is part of his voice. And in this particular novel, it works to make the novel work. Like, you need that in the novel, because part of Bendrix's character is that he is just stuck in his head and can't get out of himself. And because of that, it works. And then, of course, the meta-narrative on writing itself is absolutely fascinating to people who are writers or interested in the craft, because you're not sure exactly where Graham Greene leaves off and Maurice Bendrix begins.
Yeah.
and how those, you know, those lines between the two are very wavering and wobbling throughout the novel, and they kind of refract on each other. And that's really fascinating.
For sure. Or does it, isn't Graham Greene kind of one of those authors that's known as sort of a dual author? I remember, I think it was David mentioning when we did The Power and the Glory that Graham Greene wrote Potboilers. Maybe you could call them Potboilers, you know, some like spy novels.
Yeah, he called them entertainments.
Serious works. Entertainments. That's right. That's right. But then he wrote more works that might be considered more of more literary merit, like The End of the Affair. I don't know. The Heart of the Matter.
Power and the Glory.
The Power and the Glory. And so are the books that are accused of being melodramatic, do you know, Heidi, are those the Potboilers?
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's a good question. David?
I don't.
I'm really committed, by the way, to making, to like keeping David from just asking questions, because I know how much he loves these books and this kind of writing. And so I want, this is a three-way conversation, not just David asking questions of us.
What do you mean these kind of books? These kind of, what do you mean?
Oh, he's answering a question with a question. Interesting.
I know.
Interesting, right? Deflection.
I wasn't even asked the question.
I made a statement. I made a statement of intent. Here's what I mean by that. That actually, I'm going to turn my statement of intent into a question. David, how do you feel about Graham Greene's writing and craft?
I think it can be a little melodramatic sometimes.
David, do you think in the Potboilers or in kind of like across his authorship?
I don't know that I've seen a differentiation where people are saying that his writing is melodramatic more so in his, you know, in his entertainments, which I'll just use his term for them. Partly because in a way his entertainments are some of his harshest social critiques, and like The Third Man kind of bridges that, where it's this sort of spy story that takes place in Vienna right after World War II and ultimately became an incredible movie. And the novel was kind of an exercise before writing the screenplay, but it's very entertaining and exciting, but it's also got this really, complex critique of the political situation after the war in Europe. So I think they tend to avoid being melodramatic in part because they're a little bit cynical. I think that his more serious novels might drift that way, but I actually don't think it's because of the themes of the books. I think it's because his writing is pretty earnest. Like he writes in a way that I think, like, even as it's being cynical, the prose itself, his style has an earnestness to it that seems to borrow from like the late 19th century. And a little more so than like some of the contemporaries of his era or the people that came right after him. Like Graham Greene is definitely not like a, trying to think of someone who is sort of, you know, it's like, he's not like Don DeLillo or someone like that, who's like this mid and second half of the 20th century writer who speaks for the generation, speaks for the times, and is super cynical about it. And the writing sort of drips with that, you know, like where it's, there's like a sparseness that, not in a Hemingway sort of way, not, but in a way that's like, the world is a brutal place sort of way. And so I'm going to write in a way that meets that. I think Greene is less cynical about people's capacity to change than a lot of people were in the era. And so I think his prose has a poetry to it that maybe not a lot of, that wouldn't be there if there was a cynical core to it. And I think sometimes that can come across like melodrama, to get back to the original question. Like I think that earnestness that is in the phrasing that he puts together and in the way he thinks about the process, I think is what makes people feel like it's melodrama. And then of course these books are often about like failed romances and things like that. And so it can't help but be a little bit melodramatic, I suppose, or the characters themselves can be a little melodramatic because they're kind of woe is me about their failed relationships, if that makes sense.
But somebody like Don DeLillo, to piggyback on what you said, Don DeLillo's heart was broken long before he started writing, it seems like. We're talking about an author that like is not terribly like wildly popular maybe among listeners of this podcast. Probably but not. I think that's such a great, it's such a great comparison because I can barely read Don DeLillo. Like I recognize what a great craftsman and I get done with a chapter and I just feel like, oh my gosh, my soul just got sucked out my ear because it's so effaced of the author's any sort of like hopefulness or upward looking, you know, like task, as opposed to Graham Greene, our main character is very cynical, but we, part of the narrative that part of what's so compelling about the book is that we're kind of trying to hope alongside him. And we're trying to hope alongside Sarah Miles. Isn't it something like that? That's my experience of this book.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Heidi, do you find that this book is, where do you think that, on a scale of 0 to 10, where does this book fall on the cynicism scale? I'm trademarking cynicism scale.
Are you asking based on the section of reading this week or on the book as a whole?
Well, why don't you answer about the book as a whole, since this is the first episode, but don't give details away.
It's not cynical at all, based on the book as a whole.
Okay, so then what about this section?
Very.
So do you think then that's interesting. Do you think this is a book about going from cynicism to
hope?
What's the word for not having cynicism?
Well, it's a good question because, okay, the opposite of cynicism for some people is idealism. I don't think this book is idealistic at all as a whole, but I think it's hopeful as a whole. But the section that we just read gives us the problem of the book. And so because of that, it's cynical. And that's his problem. Like that's Maurice's problem. He's wounded. He's angry. He's deeply hurt. And he's constantly trying to get on top of that, get off of his back foot, get back in control of the situation. And because of that, he's unreliable. He makes a lot of, he talks a lot about hate, and that's the melodramatic part of it, which actually totally works for the novel. It's his constant contrast between his intense feelings of what he tries to identify as hate, which is really just thwarted desire, right? So he uses such strong language to describe what we all recognize as he didn't get what he wanted and he's mad about it.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and that's interesting. I was thinking while reading it again last night that this section alternates between this great insight into the world and into the creative process and even into other people around him, which is what a great writer has, you know, at their disposal. That's what this, one of the skills of great writing is being able to observe facts about other people's characters. But then it alternates between that with this sort of complaining, I guess.
Yeah.
I can't think of another word besides complaining, but just this idea that the world like owes him something and petty. Petty.
Yes, he's like very petty, but he's in his mind, it's like this great love affair. Like it's
this trial.
He uses like this, martyr. You know, sweeping. Yes, that's exactly it. He uses this martyrdom language for just like his petty whining, which what he's been through is actually really sad and hard, and I'm not minimizing it. And his feelings are very deep, but he's using language to describe it that is melodramatic.
One of the things that I like about this book is, or that I find fascinating about it at any rate, is I kind of think it's about, like I'm going to say this in a way that overstates it for the sake of the podcast, but I think this is a
book. Melodramatically.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But now we have to have a discussion about whether melodrama and overstatement are the same thing. I think this might be a book about what happens to a person when they think that they're the main character of their story. I think that's one of the reasons why it's such a meta story, like the concept of narrative being throughout the whole thing and like how you craft narrative, because And it makes an author, someone who creates stories, who creates characters and creates narrative and makes choices like that, the perfect gateway into an exploration of that. I actually think that's a lot of what Graham Greene is focused on. And I think part of it is because it was sort of something he struggled with. And so he's kind of working out some of his own neuroses, like almost everybody, right? Like we all feel like all the time we're the main character of our stories, when in reality we're not. We're not really any more main person in the story than like I'm not more of a main person in my story than you are, except you're just in less scenes, I guess, of my part of the story. But thinking of ourselves as being like the main character in a story is, I think, what this the flaws and the fallout of that way of looking at the world, I think, is what this book is about. And so I think that brings some of the melodramatic aspects. I think it helps put it into a different light, because I think that it's like, in a way, it's meant to show the sort of foolishness of that way of looking at things, as opposed to saying this book is lacking because it's a lesser book because there's melodrama in it. I think the melodrama is part of the point.
Exactly. I completely agree. What do you think, Tim?
I agree.
Are we done?
It doesn't strike me. Yeah. End of show. I'll be honest. It has not struck me yet as a melodramatic book. I mean, on the opening page, when he talks about, you know, this is a document of hate, I can't remember the exact words. It's not a love story, but it's a story of hate. That edged a little bit for me into melodrama, but I'll be honest. The opening section for the most part did not, but maybe I'm missing something.
I think
maybe that's not what you guys are asserting.
Maybe you have a greater appetite for melodrama.
Maybe I do.
Well, as a writer, as someone who spends his day in, you know, crafting characters and scenes and all that, I think that when you have comments about that part of what he's talking about in this book, you need to jump in whenever you want to, because I want to hear from you.
Oh, I have became a little bit obsessed last month with what other writers' outputs were, like how much did they generate, you know, in a day or in a week? And I actually found a website in which someone compiled like references from authors themselves about what their output was. And Graham Greene was one that was listed. What did he have? It says it in the opening section that we read. Excuse me. How many words?
500 a day.
That's right, 500. Stephen King's, by contrast, was something like incredible, something like 2,000 or something like that.
Wow.
Yeah. Anyway, that part really piqued my curiosity, because it's hard to know. You have to set goals for how much you're going to accomplish, and gauging whether or not the goals are too little or too much is not easy. So I found Graham Greene's 500 words a day to be, that looks like a good mark. I like 500 words a day.
How many words a day do you do?
I aim for 2 pages. What is 2 pages, 1.5 spacing at 12-point font? Man, we are like in the weeds here.
Probably like 400.
I was going to say it's about 500 a day.
Yeah. Oh, really? Okay. That's my goal. And I usually hit it.
Although you're writing plays, so there's a lot of white space on the page, so you might be cheating.
No. This is for something that's not just a play. I think for plays, it would be a different count.
It would be, yeah, really every day count. You've got to kill off one character. There's got to be at least one
exactly.
Sword fight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the mark of prosperity.
Yeah, right.
Readily prosperity.
Right. I mean, I think if you have 20 sword fights in a play, that's a good start, and you can always cut some out or add more if you need to.
Yes, exactly.
20 seems
sword
to be
fighting
the threshold.
Always makes things better.
Well, let's talk in some more depth about...
want to talk about the story thing. I want to talk about what you just said. Because not what Tim just said about sword fighting or whatever. But about the hero in your own story thing, because I totally agree that that's what this book is about. And I think that's why his whiny voice at the beginning is so compelling as you get farther along in the story. And if anyone's bogged down in it, like, keep going, because it is so good in light of the rest of the book. It's so good, and it's absolutely necessary. And craftsman wise, and I like how, and I, there's so much to talk about this book, because he keeps calling himself a craftsman, and that's what he's known for, and blah, blah, blah. And I want to talk about that. But in terms of the craftsmanship of the story, that is absolutely necessary in light of the whole rest of the book, that he is so self-absorbed here at the beginning, that, and yet Graham Greene somehow manages to communicate, even through Maurice Bendrix's whiny voice, that Sarah is a truly lovable woman, and that there's something good about her, and that he is on, that he's not getting this right. Like, and somehow, and we're not sure exactly how at the beginning, because on the other hand, they're having an affair. She's cheating on her husband with him. And we don't know whether or not she has another lover at this point and what's going on between them. So there's enough mystery to keep you going to figure out what's happening between them. And there's enough information for us to know that there's something compelling about Sarah. And there's enough to really get to know Maurice. Do you guys like him in this part of the book? Like, do you find him likable?
No. Do you, David?
I don't, man, that's a hard, I guess not. The question had never occurred to me until you asked it. Like, I'm realizing that I don't know that I think about, although I ask the question sometimes of you guys, I don't necessarily think about characters that way, especially early in books, because I feel like I don't know them very well, you know? And so, and then also there's the concept of like trying to separate the first section from the rest of the book for me. I know, but no, he's like, I think he's kind of inherently unlikable. but also the problem here is people find him likable. Like, people trust him. Like, Henry right. Finds him likable and wants to talk to him. But then on the other hand, you've got not Savage, but Savage's man. What's his name? The boy.
I want to say Portis, but I don't think that's right.
Something like that, yeah.
Yes.
He's Porcus. Like...
Porcus.
Maybe
Porcus.
Either he's really bad at his job, or maybe Morris is just not memorable. That's the other thing I was wondering. Like, is it possible he's just not a memorable guy? But he thinks he's memorable, and that's like, I love the way his own opinion of himself keeps kind of pushing up against other people's opinions of him, and he seems unaware of the fact that they're pushing up against each other. And sometimes he thinks worse of himself, but other people think better. And sometimes he thinks better of himself, and other people seem to think worse of him. And there's like this conflict; these things are constantly colliding with one another. But he does seem kind of inherently like not like a great dude,
right? Well, and you have to wonder, what is it? Like, and this is why the voice of the novel works so well, is at the beginning, we get just him. And this whole time I'm wondering, what would I think of him if I weren't stuck in his head with him? What if I was out? What if I actually knew this man? Would I find him more likable than the inside of his head is? Because he seems like just really a jerk here. And which is interesting, because usually when you're reading a first person novel, you're all for the narrator. This is where Graham Greene, I think, is a genius in this book. Because usually when I'm reading first person novels, I'm almost always like, I almost always like the character, and then I have to get outside him to dislike him.
Well, I think
here's the opposite.
Sorry.
That's all.
Well, I was just going to say, I think that this is why the meta discourse is effective and necessary in this book, because if you're going to have a narrator who you are sort of primed to dislike, then you have to at least have the suspicion that change is possible. And so the concept of narrative arc is inherently wound up in the notion of going from one place to another. And so that idea of change, that the character is going to evolve and become something different or learn some kind of a lesson, or, you know, start one place and be in another place at the end, that's implicit within the structure, not just the structure of the book, but within the themes of the book. And so you can feel like he is going to be a different person at the end in a way that is positive. And I think that allows Green to give us this character who is not the kind of guy you want to spend a lot of time with, except that he's at least got a little bit of wit about him.
Yeah. I was thinking about how much I like Raskolnikov from Crime and Punishment. And it's not a first person. Crime and Punishment is not first person, but it's, practically speaking, it's a first person narrative. We're with Raskolnikov. I like him. He's an axe murderer. I can't stand Maurice, and his sins are comparatively small. And I do think, like you said, Heidi, it's a testament to kind of Graham Greene's project and his ability that Maurice is so... There's an inner world for Maurice, and there's an outer world. In the outer world, we see that Sarah falls in love with him. We see that Henry trusts him. We see all these kind of like interactions that say, oh, this is a person who's likable, he's affable. And then when we are just alone in the room with Maurice, oh, he's difficult. He is just singular, almost not about singularly unpleasant, but he's an unpleasant character to be around, to just be stuck in his own head with.
Right.
I'll just ask this question. Do you think he still loves Sarah?
When is when, David? At the beginning of the book?
Yeah, they're in this section. I mean, I know that the section jumps in time, but let's take the present time as opposed to the scenes that he's recalling.
Yes, I do. I think that, you know, there's probably a distinction to be made between, you know, love in the sense of charity that is actually redeeming to our lives, and love in the sense of desire for possession that is kind of takes over the mind and the soul. And it's definitely the latter for him. And absolutely more of an obsession at this point. Yes, not the former. Like, he does not love her with any kind of charity. He becomes more self-absorbed as a result of his love for her.
He loves her for what she...
fragmented and broken as a person. But that's, you know, kind of part of the commentary on adultery and division that we have in this novel and the nature of marriage. And but in terms of the latter, he is absolutely obsessed with this woman and desires her and wants to possess her. Absolutely. And I think has a real affection for her. Like, he is drawn to her and attached to her. What do you think, guys?
I think you're right, Heidi. I don't think that he, if love is, as you said, like true charity, like the seeking of someone else's betterment, no matter what the cost to you, I don't know that he ever loves Sarah. Maybe he does at some point in the book, but certainly not when we kind of join him after the affair.
Right.
He wants to possess.
And his description of the affair is exactly the same. Like, he is so driven to possess her body and soul, and so motivated by jealousy, which is the nature of adultery. And that's part of the thread of this novel too. So his love doesn't change after it's over. It's exactly the same as it was when they were doing it. And it's been a long time. So I don't know, David, what are your thoughts on that?
I think that you guys are right. I mean, I don't know that. I think the idea of obsession and possession, I think, is really interesting. I read somewhere, it might have been a dust jacket of one of the books, but the idea that it's the story of a of a man who's trying to, I can't remember how they put it, something like either destroy or reclaim, destroy M dash or reclaim M dash, his former lover or something like that. And that, like, that little bit of phrasing in copy on the, on, in a description of a book is fascinating, right? Destroy or reclaim. And wow, the reclaim is just sort of off to an aside. It's not like destroy or win back. It's destroy or reclaim. And the aggression, like the aggression at the heart of that, of those two words, like even the word that is meant to be like about them reconciling, the word reclaim is still an aggressive word. It's not that much
great
less
point
aggressive than destruction. So I got to thinking about, you know, the way he wrote about her in the book, and what you just said sparked this thought, Heidi, because every time he talks about her and the things that he misses about her are like, he speaks in terms of ownership. So,
yes,
you know, he's upset because, you know, earlier on when the affair is active, he's upset because Henry's going to be the one that gets to kiss her or whatever. And so, you know, he's always talking about how Henry has this, like, because it has the possession that he does not have. And that's the thing that upsets him. It's not that he misses something about her. It's that someone else gets something he doesn't get to have. And then he's constantly talking about like the footsteps, and like, there's all these very physical, sensory, you know, like just in terms of things he's hearing or smelling or whatever, details that are what he thinks about when he thinks about her. And it's less about her and more about these, like, these things that he knows that Henry is experiencing. And so it's so much more about himself and like what she does for him, and less about her and who she is. And so, right, we're kind of left as the readers to get to know her for who she is, as opposed to what she is as a possession for Morris. And then also for Henry to a certain extent, although Henry is kind of a cipher. He's kind of a, we don't really know him because he's, I mean, like the amount of sympathy that the narrator has for him varies from time to time. And so you kind of have to read between the lines when you get to know Henry. But I was thinking about how there's just two times, it's probably two of my favorite passages in this section, in chapter six. So part one, chapter six, I'm in the Penguin book, and it's pages 38 and 39. There's a section, this paragraph that begins, but it was quite easy to return to work under those conditions. So this is like the second full paragraph in that chapter. He's talking about writing, his writing, and he has this aside, and he says, as long as one is happy, one can endure any discipline. It was unhappiness that broke down the habit of work. When I began to realize how often we quarreled, how often I picked on her with nervous irritation, I became aware that our love was doomed. Love had turned into a love affair with a beginning and an end. Which that beginning and end line, of course, refers back to the opening line of the book. Story has no beginning and an end.
Right, right.
And we can talk about that in a minute. Put a pin in that, I guess. And then it says, I could name the very moment when it had begun. And one day I knew I should be able to name the final hour. When she left the house, I couldn't settle to work. I would reconstruct what we had said to each other. I would fan myself into anger or remorse. All the time, I knew I was forcing the pace. I was pushing the only thing I loved out of my life. As long as I could make believe that love lasted, I was happy. I think I was even good to live with, and so love did last. But if love had to die, I wanted it to die quickly. It was as though our love were a small creature caught in a trap and bleeding to death. I had to shut my eyes and wring its neck. And then, so we get this image here of the creature caught in a trap and bleeding to death, which again, it's pretty aggressive. And then if you turn the page, I think it's the next page. No, go back one page. Okay, here it is.
It's back. Are you talking about the animal thing?
Yeah. So it says on page 37, she turned her head sharply away as though she were looking to see if anyone was coming, to see if there was time. But when she turned again, the cough took her. She doubled up in the doorway and coughed. Her eyes were red with it. In her fur coat, she looked like a small animal cornered. And so he keeps referring to her as this trapped, and their relationship is this animal that's trapped in a cage, this like bloody violent, this violent image. And there seems like a sort of, it speaks to this idea of ownership, you know, it even like alludes to the idea of like a slave being trapped. And so the sees her looking back is so dark in that way. And there's just not like, there's just not a lot of normal expression of affection from her about her. I was looking for it. I was trying to find, like, where does he actually say, like, he doesn't really even talk about how she's beautiful, right? Or he doesn't talk about how she's, like, she's appealing because of what she represents to him or means to him or what can do for him and not for who she is. And that's, you know, that says everything, you know, in a way.
Agreed. Well, he even talks about resenting her beauty and how he doesn't desire beautiful women because they make him feel inferior, which is very telling. And
yes,
there's so much self-revelation in this section about this character that's completely, I don't want to say it's completely unconscious. There are other books in which the revelation is unconscious. And this, I think, he knows himself relatively well. He just is on his own side, as you pointed out. He thinks he's the hero in his story. There's no repentance at this point. There's no sense of that, you know, the blame is all for his own unhappiness is always directed outward. It's her fault. It's Henry's fault. It's the reviewer's fault. It's everybody else's fault that he is so unhappy and so jealous and so angry, and so full of hate. And that, so it isn't just that he doesn't know. In some ways he does know himself. He knows beautiful women make me feel inferior. He knows that, but he puts the wrong judgment on that. And I think we see that throughout this whole first section, which I think that's part of what makes him so profoundly unlikable, is that he never takes responsibility for his own unhappiness. It's always somebody else's fault.
Tim, did you want to add something?
No, I did not pick up on the thing that you noted, David, about when she was coughing, Sarah was like a small creature cornered. And then on the next page, their love was a small animal that needed to be killed. That was great. I hadn't seen that before.
The stuff about the coughing, you know, the book is so, it's Graham Greene, right? It's Power and the Glory. Had this too. It's all these illusions and images of sickness and disease and, you know, the sort of physical manifestation, the objective correlative for interior disorientation is so almost on the nose, but on the other hand, on a way that's like insightful. Like, you know, it's a little like I could see people complaining that it's a little bit too metaphorical for the characters' interior lives, but it also plays because it's so human. Like it just, you feel it so much. Like it's not even, you've got these stories like in the jungle, right? and the things that are meant to represent the interior lives are so foreign to people who live in, like, you know, Concord, North Carolina in 2020. But yet the way he presents them make them so universally human. That's why I think, you know, I think that they work because of that, even if it feels a little bit on the nose, like a little bit too archetypal in some ways. On the other hand, archetypes stay archetypes for a reason, I suppose. Mm-hmm. What were you going to say, Heidi?
Well, I was going to ask you both. This is a real question, not like set up for my own answer. Like, this is like a real question. What do you make of Mr. Parkes? Like, there's so few characters in this novel that every single one of them is intentional. So I guess I do have a comment. Here it is. But my real question is, to your point about archetypes, is this an archetypal character? Is this just kind of a human insertion of some, like, what purpose does this particular guy serve in the novel so far? What did you make of him?
Tim, I want to hear this from you as a person who has to weave characters and think about their purposes within a story. So how do you take Parkes?
I, first off, love how well drawn he is. Yeah. Like he's only on stage for a little amount of time. And he's, I feel like I know this guy. Like I just know him so well because he's so well drawn. How do I say this? I think that he kind of serves a couple of purposes. He is a detective. He supplies Maurice with information, just kind of like brute cold facts that Maurice then absorbs and kind of translates according to his own, what's the word we're going to use? It's more than just like almost like a narcissism. Like, you know, he everything that the detective gives him kind of becomes evidence against Sarah. However, there's this one moment where, and this I thought was just a great bit of stagecraft. All of my nomenclature is playwriting nomenclature. When the detective reports that Sarah, the party in question, was with a man who he could not identify. And as the reader, we like, oh, we know who it is. It's Maurice. This is going to be so satisfying when he reveals himself. And I thought it was like so well done for two reasons. It's both kind of like thrilling as an audience member to know what the detective does not know, but also, as David says, Maurice gets to be the kind of star, the hidden star in his own story for a little bit. You know, ha ha, it was me that she was with. You didn't see it. You know what I mean? Like, I wonder if there was, Maurice appreciated the humor of the moment, but I think maybe even more, he appreciated that he was the central character in the reporting, just like he is in his own head. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes. I know. I really like that. I think that's good. All right. David, what did you make of Mr. Parkus?
I like what Tim said. I also think there's like a humorousness about him, a light, like that the story could use. His drooping mustache and he drops the beer and the way he thinks about his kid. And it's like full of humor and pathos at the same time. And also, of course, there's the famous line where it says, the end of the section, it says, I become nearly human enough to think of another person's trouble when he's hearing the story.
Yeah.
So that, you know, that I think, as you said, it takes him out of his own head. But I also think there's like a circularity that his character introduces to the novel. So this is a novel about watching people. and you get a lot of scenes where, just kind of on a very basic level, Maurice is watching what's happening in Sarah and Henry's house. And so he's trying to deduce all these facts about him, almost like a detective. And he's trying to work out how he can, you know, insert himself into the situation and so forth. And then you've got Henry's watching his wife, and then he hires the detective. And then Sarah is also watching Henry, trying to figure out what's going on. And so This is a book about people watching other people, trying to figure out what their actions mean. Like, what does what you're doing mean to me? And how do I interpret the actions that you're taking? And so we have to have the detective character in the book because it formalizes that action of watching, but also because it then turns the watching on the narrator. He's not just watching other people, and he's not, which is what a good narrator does, but he's also not just spying on, you know, his former lover or spying on his friend's wife or what, however you want to look at it. He's also being watched. And so as the narrator, or as he's describing to Bendrix what he saw, it's also the concept of it being turned on him. And there's the idea of circularity and repetitiveness comes up a lot in this book. So at the end of the chapter we read, even there's this idea of, she said it would be better if I called you, she told me. And caution, I thought, caution, how well she knows how to conduct an affair like this. And I remembered again that stare that always was the word she used, squeaked. So even there, at the end of the section, there's this idea of always, like of eternity, of circularity, of repetition, how she's probably done this before. And that idea keeps coming up. And I think that there's this circle of watching as well, this kind of never ending, like if, unless someone breaks the circle, it just goes on forever. And I think that he represents
that theme in a sort of formal, practical way in the story.
Mm. Yeah. It occurred to me also, while you were talking, David, that the detective, Mr. Parkes, loves his son, like genuinely loves his son. And in that way is another contrast with Maurice. So the detective is willing to kind of own his own faults and shortcomings, and because he wants his son to kind of thrive and surpass him. And so he's a very unselfish man. He's kind of, he's representative sort of a blunderer. But he is a really dignified man. He's a man who really wants his son to thrive and is willing to admit his faults and shortcomings to help his son thrive. Another contrast with our main character, who that's just not possible for Maurice at this point in the story. He couldn't do such a thing. He couldn't let Sarah go because it would be so destructive to himself, he believes. Yeah,
there's a nobility about him.
There is.
Not about
him. Even though everything on the outward appearance is just the opposite. The outward appearance of him is, you know, he's lower class. For me, he sounds a little bit cockney. You know, he just doesn't have, he's drooping, as Heidi said, his eyes are, or his mustache is drooping. Like he doesn't cut a refined figure, but inside him, he's a noble person.
Hmm. Heidi, go ahead. You're on the edge of your seat. Literally, but.
Right. This is helpful for me. I find him just a little bit mysterious, and this puts him in a context for me. And I think also he provides an opportunity for Maurice to see himself from the outside. That, you know, Maurice is hunting for Sarah's lover, and he is Sarah's lover, right? Like it's him. He's the culprit that he's hunting for. And he can't see himself. He has to actually pay somebody in order to see himself clearly. Like there's just this constant element of blindness to Maurice. And even I really like that David pointed out the cornered animal image for Sarah, and that in one part, in one counterpart of that image, he's the culprit. Like he's the one who has her cornered, is about to kill her. And in the other, we're not sure yet who the culprit is, right? And that's part of the mystery of the story. This is in some ways a mystery story. He is trying to hunt down Sarah's lover, and there is a lover, we just don't know who it is. And but at the same time, it's also always him. So there's just these multiple levels of meaning in this story. It's a very simple on one hand and very complex on the other. And Mr. Parkes is in some ways the guy who's, he's maybe the vessel of the ordinary person who's looking in from the outside and just like, this guy is who she's having an affair with.
Yeah.
And it's him the whole time.
Yeah. It's just, he's just back. He's like Tim said, he's about the facts.
Yeah. And that's an opportunity for Maurice to see himself, and he can't yet.
Well, I'm so glad that you mentioned the inside outside thing, because they have a conversation about that. Yeah. So at the end of
every time I want to look at something with two hands, like move my hand, I gotta put my phone down. Chapter 6, towards the end of that, it says, "He bent his head and sat there looking into his hat, which lay on his knees. I tried to cheer him up. Oh, it's not serious," I said. "If you look at it from the outside, it's really quite funny. But I'm on the inside, sir," he said.
Yeah.
And so here, and it says he turned his hat round and went on in a voice as damp and dreary as the common outside. "It's not Mr. Savage I mind about, sir. It's my boy," he goes on. I actually think that the fact that he turned his hat around there is important. Because I really believe that the images of circularity in this book are all over the place. And I think the green is doing that on purpose. Because I think that on the one hand, this inside outside thing is an opportunity, as Heidi said, for him, for Bendrix to get outside of himself. You know, he even says here, I'm on the outside, you're on the inside. But then he says that it's really quite funny. And in a way, we can also invert that and say, you know, what if we look on the, if we look at the outside and Bendrix is on the inside, there's a sort of patheticness about Bendrix too, just like there's a sort of patheticness from being on the outside of Parcus's side. But then on the other hand, it there's like this idea of being inside and outside the circle that I was talking about, like the circle of all the watching. And right now, Parcus, as he says, is on the inside of that circle of watching, and he brings us to the inside of that circle. So I'm really fascinated by what Green is doing here with this idea of like watching and circles and being on the inside and the outside, and the way that kind of changes the nature of conflict in the book, because you're not really totally sure who's in the circle and who's outside of the circle, and who's partnering with who, and who's not partnering with who, and who's out to get another person. And, you know, all the different relationships become intertwined in a way that's very complex. And as you said, it has a mystery about it that we get to unravel as the readers. And also, you know, of course he's wearing a bowler hat.
You just mean like his character would? Is that what you mean, David?
Yeah, he's got a droopy mustache.
Yeah.
Obviously.
He's wearing a bowler hat while he drinks his pint. And
right. Well, because of that, he's both a stock character and, as Tim pointed out, a completely human character, Parcus is. Like, he has this personhood to him, but, you know, based on what you're saying, David, he should be just kind of another, like, kind of 1940s stock character, right? With the bowler hat and the droopy mustache and the Cockney accent and the job. But Graham Greene brings him to life, especially with the boy. This is a person who actually knows how to love somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the questions of the novel. I find it so interesting that everybody is watching Sarah. Like, again, there's few characters in this novel. This is not like a sweeping panorama of life. Like, this is a very intimate domestic novel. And she is at the center of everything. And everybody is watching her. Yes. And if it's a circle, right, in the center. And there's
this, like the elephant down in the ring.
Yes. And I think there's something, in some ways, what's brilliant about that, there's something very Catholic about that. This is a very Catholic novel, that there's this kind of luminous woman at the center of everything. And she's kind of infused with light, illuminated throughout this entire novel. But right now she's an adulteress. That's what we know about her. We know she's likable, and we know that she is married to one man and sleeping with another man, and that there's havoc in her wake. But somehow we're still drawn to her as the reader. And I think that's brilliant on the part of Graham Greene. I don't know how he could do that at this point, knowing what we know about what she's doing and how much Bendrix wants us to believe he hates her. And yet somehow we're like, she's the lovable one in this novel so far.
Yeah.
Well, her sickness helps with that. The fact that she's ill, she seems weak. She seems oppressed, like the cage metaphor is all, like, I think he has very subtly made us feel sorry for her in a way. Right. And also, we know that he's so mean to her and all that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It has to start with her, you know, even though we know that she's flawed. It has to start with her getting kind of thematically beaten on, because otherwise it doesn't work. Otherwise, there's not going to be that mystery about her. We're just going to kind of be like, meh, who cares?
You guys, can I ask a plot question? I feel like I missed something in the timeline that it didn't like really bother me when I was reading it. But when I finished, I was confused. I thought, wait, I didn't put something together right in my head. Let me try to explain what it is. The opening of the book, Maurice meets Henry, the writer meets the husband, and Henry is preoccupied because he thinks that Sarah is seeing someone, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he wants to hire a detective, and Maurice is willing to kind of stand in for him and say, no, I'll take this for you because it'd be so unpleasant for you as a husband. I'm willing to do this. Okay. My question is, where are Maurice and Sarah. Is the affair, the affair's over, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's the 18, it's 18 months later.
Yeah.
So when Maurice meets with the detective later, mm-hmm. he is not the man that the detective is actually looking for.
No,
he's a past lover.
But he yes. is the man that the detective saw in the restaurant because right. they had lunch, but right. he's not the one right. that Henry wants to know about.
Yes, right.
Right.
Okay.
At the, and he's also not the one that Maurice wants to know about.
Right.
Yes, right. Which is another, I mean, to your point, David, I had not noticed the circles, but it's another circle in the novel that Maurice and Sarah had an affair in the past. And now we believe that Sarah is repeating. She is like circling and mm-hmm. doing the same thing again, 18 months after her affair with Maurice.
Right. That's his suspicion. And that's Henry's suspicion. Now, both mm-hmm. of these men mm-hmm. that love her suspect that she is cheating on them,
yeah.
which she would be on Henry and not on Maurice, but that's a matter to him. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
What is the famous definition of a line from
Euclid?
Euclid. A line is that which has no, what?
Well, my dad. Well, he's always quoting the point, right? A point is that which has no part.
Yeah, yeah. A point is that which has no part.
Yeah, I don't know about the line, though.
Okay,
what were you thinking, David?
Well, I'm just thinking about that opening line, because a story has no beginning or end. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering if, like, I mean, the idea of not having a beginning or end, what doesn't have a beginning or end? Only a circle, right?
Yes.
And so I'm...
Yes.
Like, that's right there from the beginning, but I'm wondering if it's meant to be, like... Like the idea of narrative itself is usually, you know, you can draw it out on a line. There's like, you know, the concept of narrative shape, you know, we think about it in triangles and you can build outlines and all that kind of stuff. So it seems like he's doing something there that I guess I want to think about it in terms of the geometry of what he's saying about narrative and how it works. And like that line or that line of story has no beginning or end. It feels like it's a direct allusion to Euclid or some geometry book. Like if there was some definition of a circle that says like a circle is that which has no beginning or end, I wouldn't be surprised. But the idea that right. he says arbitrarily one chooses that moment of experience from when to look back or from which to look ahead. And I wanted to ask you before we go as kind of a final point, does it seem like he uses the word arbitrarily, but does that seem like the right word to you? Like, does that seem that, why does Graham Greene make his narrator say the word arbitrarily there?
I think that is such a great question because it kind of forces us to pay attention then to his other point in that paragraph, which is when he says, but do I in fact of my own will choose that black, wet January night on the common in 1946, the sight of Henry Miles slanting across the wide river of rain, or did these images choose me? It is convenient. It is correct according to the rules of my craft to begin just there. But if I had believed then in a God, I could also have believed in a hand plucking at my elbow, a suggestion, speak to him. He hasn't seen you yet.
There's so much going on in this paragraph.
Oh my gosh, it's mm-hmm. so brilliant. And then mm-hmm. the next page, he describes how he doesn't want to speak to Henry. He doesn't want to talk to him. He could have just walked right by him, but instead he feels compelled to. So, in that sense, to not answer your question, but just to deepen the mystery of the question, right? Like, it almost seems as though he's claiming both that it is completely arbitrary and that there was such a hand on his arm saying, this is the beginning point.
Well, I think that, you know, he says, if I had believed then in a God, which
right.
which suggests a lot, just as like, I say with one chooses with the inaccurate pride of a professional writer who has been praised for his technical ability, like it's being self-deprecating and yet it's also being revealing to us as readers. With your outside of the character, the number of things he implies in this single paragraph is kind of amazing.
You know, the idea of the line being contrasted with a circle, it's a very Christian or Jewish Christian. Let me back up. I think the pagan world previous to Christianity or the kind of influence of the Jews thought of history as a recurring circle. The seasons change. So winter, spring, summer, fall, plants die and are reborn after the seeding. So you can see in nature this recurring circle over and over. Nietzsche talks over and over about kind of the recurring cycle of history, and like, let's stop thinking about history in terms of a timeline. And historians kind of universally acknowledge that the introduction of the idea of history as an arrow that is going in a certain direction is something that was given by the Jews on their way to the promised land from the wilderness. Christians on their way to salvation.
Like the notion of progress?
Yes.
Yes, the notion of progress is a Christian notion. And so I even wonder if I would need to like think about this throughout the reading of the book. If Maurice is kind of being contrasted as the pagan who cannot understand like the sort of like arrow the kind of narrative arrow that is going to be Sarah's life.
I think that's interesting because I like that. I think that I'm going to think about that, Tim. I think that's really interesting because once you get to the medieval scholastics and later medieval thinkers, there is still a notion of circles and time. But as Dante put it, those cycles on a mountain, right, that's moving upwards. And I think that's when you get to this kind of mid-20th century tormented Catholic imagination, these novels, Evelyn Waugh, Graham Greene, and then even Eliot, that there's this obsession of the contemplation of cycles, how cycles and progress can work together.
Yes, right, right. Right.
How they tell the same story of God's redeeming love. And I find it so fascinating that these are all, without exception, reluctant converts to the faith that still were very tormented through, and you see it in their writing and you see it in their prose, you see it in their interviews. Like Graham Greene did not want to be a Christian. And he considered himself heterodox all the way through his entire life. And at the time he wrote this, he was having an affair with a married woman. And so there's just so much of that question of how can I be both progressing towards the kingdom and still mired in the temptations of this world? And how can I be both flesh and spirit? Like it's just this exploration of Romans 7 in a lot of ways. And it's brilliant. Like I love it because I feel that very, very much in my own spiritual walk. And so seeing it reflected in these stories is like great comfort to me. Like,
yeah.
Makes a brilliant novel with all these layers of meaning and mystery embedded within them.
Well, yeah, that opening paragraph, we've talked on this show before about how really excellent writers can put the whole novel in the opening sentence or maybe the opening paragraph. And the whole novel is in this opening paragraph. It might be fun to reread it once we've finished the last chapter.
Yeah, for sure. And there's even a few sections that allude to it again, I think there's two times that allude to that opening line or the opening paragraph just in the section we read this time. So that suggests it's probably going to happen again.
Yeah.
Well, we should probably wrap this up. Any final thoughts from either of you?
I do have a final thought. I was going to let Tim go first because I just talked for a really long time.
We'll bracket it.
Okay. The image of the unfaithful wife and the image of adultery is not just in this novel that this is used. Like, this is a very biblical image. This is a very, just with a very modern twist to it. But I think it's brilliant how Graham Greene did that. He kind of lifted this image from the pages of scripture in which the unfaithful wife is the bad guy in the story. It's, and rightly so. Unfaithfulness is wrong. So adultery is a very grave sin. But he upends it a little bit. He subverts that a little bit in a lot, actually, in this novel. And I think he does it in a very, he kind of takes that fable, that allegory, and changes it. And so I've been thinking about it this time as I'm reading it, tracing this allegory of redeeming love. And instead of villainizing the unfaithful wife, we have a little bit of a situation of Christ writing in the sand and saying, he who has not committed sin throw the first stone, right? There's just as much of an emphasis on the lover with whom she is unfaithful as there is on her. Mm. And I think that's just brilliant, but it's a very scriptural allegory.
Hmm. Proverbs. Hmm. The wisdom of the woman in Proverbs 31 is contrasted with the adulterous woman who's kind of like waiting in the doorway, seeking to kind of entice the young man who hasn't. Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. That's a great point, Heidi.
What are y'all's final thoughts?
Yeah, David. I don't have one, David. Do you have one?
No, I think I'm good. Graham Greene. Well, as I texted you guys last night, Graham Greene is a good writer. So
great success.
Yeah. Graham Greene's always, his books are always, you know, even in their moments when you're kind of like, that's not Graham Greene at his peak. They're always interesting. Like, there's always something to talk about. So I think this will be a great conversation. I enjoyed that people were posting on social media, like things like some of the comments were, I read this whole thing in one day. I can't wait to hear you guys talk about it and talk about it on the Facebook page. And then there were people who were like, we just finished Anne and we're in quarantine and I don't know if I'm ready to be depressed again. And I totally get that. So, you know, if it's too depressing, then we understand and we'll see you.
Keep next going though.
Time we don't.
Yeah.
This isn't the whole novel.
Yeah,
I did think, David, like it was either like a really fortuitous accident or a touch of genius. I'm going to say it's a touch of genius.
Of course,
that
is.
You kind of bracketed Anne of Green Gables with The Catcher in the Rye and End of the Affair. Like, if we had to go straight from Catcher in the Rye to the End of the Affair, that would have been hard. It would have been like pacing through the desert. But Anne of Green Gables gave us a green flourish between.
Very nice.
Yeah, well said. I want to remind people that you can join the conversation. There is a Facebook page, of course. Head over there to plenty of chatter about The End of the Affair. There's also Instagram. We're at Close Reads Podcast. And then if you can follow the sign up for the newsletter. That's closereads.substack.com. If you want to email us directly, of course, it's closereadspodcast@gmail.com. And don't forget about the Patreon episodes on Crime and Punishment. We have another one coming soon. So head over to patreon.com/closereads. And then we also have The Play's the Thing, all five episodes, plus a bonus episode of Tim and Heidi's conversation about As You Like It is now available. And then coming soon will be Tim's conversation with Sarah Jane Bentley about Coriolanus, right? That's what you said?
Yes.
So go binge those As You Like It episodes. They did a great job. If you like As You Like It as much as I do, you definitely need to listen to those. So there's plenty of content. I also got the Daily Poem, of course, and a number of other things coming down the pipeline. So, you know, binge away, I guess, is what I'm saying. And with that, for Heidi White and for Tim McIntosh, I'm David Kern. Thanks so much for listening. Talk to you next time. And until then, happy reading.